Therapy Notes is the highest rated EHR, practice management, and billing software for mental health professionals. Its all-in-one platform is designed to streamline all aspects of your practice, from connecting with clients via secure messages to scheduling, notes, billing, and more. You can trust Therapy Notes has you covered. And one of the best parts? 24/7 customer service with a live person. It's beyond easy to get help over the phone or by email at any time of day from their knowledgeable and friendly representatives. The best time to give Therapy Notes a try is now. Sign up for your free trial by going to therapynotes.com, clicking Start My Free Trial, and accessing your first 2 months free with the promo code CHAT. See why Therapy Notes is the most trusted EHR for behavioral health professionals today.
Therapists, ready to stop just listening and start doing? I offer several ways to work with me and accelerate your trauma expertise. You can join my Trauma Therapist Network membership community for ongoing support, book a one-on-one clinical consultation with me for personalized guidance, or buy my course for clinicians on supporting survivors of sexual trauma, and check out the retreats coming up in 2026. All that info and more is on the For Therapists page of Trauma Therapist Network, and you can find a link in the show notes.
Therapy Chat Podcast, episode 519.
This is the Therapy Chat Podcast with Laura Reagan, LCSWC. The information shared in this podcast is not a substitute for seeking help from a licensed mental health professional. And now, here's your host, Laura Reagan, LCSWC.
Hi, welcome back to Therapy Chat. I'm your host, Laura Reagan, and today bringing you another fascinating conversation with Dr. Kathy Malchiotti. Dr. Kathy Malchiotti is an internationally known psychotherapist and expressive arts therapist who has helped shape the field of traumatic stress through her decades of work with children, adults, families, and communities. Kathy is the author of numerous publications, including several best-selling books that have become standards in the fields of expressive arts therapy, art therapy, trauma recovery, and creative approaches to clinical practice. Dr. Malchiotti promotes a capacity-focused, neurodiversity-affirming approach to traumatic stress grounded in evidence-informed expressive arts therapy and sensory integration, drawing on principles of EMDR, somatic therapy, arts therapies, and sensory processing. She developed bilateral movement desensitization and resensitization, an innovative model to facilitate trauma recovery and restore health and well-being. She's a popular presenter, having delivered more than 750 invited keynotes and workshops around the world. She's the founder and executive director of the Trauma-Informed Practices and Expressive Arts Therapy Institute, a source of education and professional development for over 30,000 psychotherapists, counselors, creative arts therapists, somatic educators, and coaches. And she has held 7 academic appointments and is the recipient of many awards, including Kennedy Center Honors, research grants, and several university fellowships. We had a beautiful conversation that I can't wait to share with you. So let's dive right into my conversation with Dr. Kathy Malchiotti. Hi, welcome back to Therapy Chat. I'm your host, Laura Reagan, and today I'm so happy to be joined by Dr. Kathy Malchiotti. Kathy, thank you so much for being my guest today on Therapy Chat.
Yeah, it's great. I think this has taken a long time for us to get together. I was just thinking that. So it's great to be here.
I know. I've been wanting to interview you for a long time, and I'm really happy that we're finally doing it. And, you know, can't wait to see what comes from it. And we're going to talk about this fabulous book, Trauma and Expressive Arts Therapy: Brain, Body, and Imagination in the Healing Process. So I've got a lot of things I want to ask you about your work. But before we get started, can you just let our audience know a little bit more about who you are and what you do?
Yeah, that's like a life story, so I'll try to keep it brief. But my focus for decades has been around, I would say, arts-based approaches, and that came out of the fact that I started out as a visual artist, but was not interested in actually being an artist who just sold their work. I could always see the connection between the arts and, I'll just say, healing, you know, just as a general term. And that led me into studying, as this came online over decades, the whole field of art therapy. And then eventually we'll talk more about as expressive arts therapy. And also becoming a psychologist and a mental health counselor. And, you know, all the training that so many of us, if you're a practitioner, you gather over a lifetime. And putting that all together. And you know, in this decade, we know so much more about why these nonverbal kinds of ways of helping people towards recovery, towards repair, towards restoration are really helpful because of all the brain science and also the understanding of sensory processing. So I'm highlighting that because in the beginning, I kind of had an inkling of that decades ago, but now we're getting this real understanding. And that's kind of where the book came from, but also now where I'm thinking and writing again, something that's more practical about all those connections. So, and I also wanted to say practice-wise, I started out working first with domestic violence and did that for quite a few years, just strictly that. Still see that in my practice. But over the last, well, since about 2008, work with military, either active military or military who are veterans, consider themselves veterans now. And then more recently with the Department of Education, I'm doing a research grant for trauma-informed expressive arts therapy that came from, you know, doing that book and researching how that works in classrooms with our stress students and also our stress teachers. So this has been just a really interesting evolution over all these decades, very diverse kinds of things that I hope people are picking up on applies to not just children, but applies to the whole lifespan and how people can benefit from pretty simple kinds of arts-based practices in their reparation, especially from trauma. So that was long. I'll stop there.
That was great. And I always feel a kinship with anyone who started out in like gender-based violence work because sexual violence was where I started. And, you know, our center had, obviously there's a lot of overlap between sexual and domestic violence. People with DV have experienced sexual violence. People with sexual violence have experienced intimate partner violence. So I love that starting point as a different approach to mental health from the typical, like, well, now typical medical behaviorally oriented model that we see the most often, I think. So I love that we have the chance to talk about expressive arts and sensory processing.
Yeah. Well, I was going to go back to the interpersonal violence angle too. You know, I came into that as a first job. And I have to say that was so long ago that the word trauma was not even on the menu yet. We talked about crisis, but trauma was not a word. And so it was a training ground for everyone at those facilities. I was at shelters and also protective services, all these different things that go into that. Everybody was learning from each other on the staff. We were, you know, frantically looking for information about how do we support people who have been through these kinds of situations where there's a war going on in your home and you can't escape it. Only way you can escape it is to go to these places, sheltered. What do we offer? What can we offer people? Now, you probably know this so well. People that have been through these kinds of circumstances don't necessarily want to talk about it. There's a lot of reasons. Now we know kind of neuroscience-wise, if there's trauma severe, language is not available. But in interpersonal violence and sexual assault, domestic violence, however you want to identify that, you are also feeling like you need to keep that a secret because you can get hurt more if that is revealed in some way. So then I started to see this like, wow, even in the children and also, you know, mostly shelters, they were there with their mother. That was a way to communicate without talking. And that was so powerful to see that that was a way that finally I can be witness. I can tell the story here, but I don't have to say it with words because I'm a little bit afraid. I don't know if I say that out loud, but somehow to get that experience out on paper and movement or sound or all these different things, that was the real powerful lesson that I got early on and thought, yeah, this is something I need to pursue, you know, because this may be the only way of communication for a lot of people, you know. And as I'm saying, I'm just talking about that interpersonal violence situation, but it goes well beyond that.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, just to name this out loud, when you say that you work with many clients now who are active duty military or veterans, in my experience working with people who have military service, so many of the clients I've worked with, there may be combat trauma, but the childhood trauma that they experienced before they went into the military is what they really are asking for the most help with, that's impacting them the most throughout their lives. And it's not to, you know, say one's more important than the other in any way, but, you know, that's such a common childhood experience before someone joins the military.
And also, there is a lot of interpersonal violence in relationships with that high level of stress and trauma that comes along with that. There are a lot of stress military families. So there's a component of all that where that comes back as well. And people need some way to work through that again in a similar way, even though it's not of protective service organization or a shelter or all these different places, it's happening. And yeah, the stress level is enormous and causes these kinds of dynamics again.
Right. And then there's not, you know, the culture of the environment of being a part of the military or other first responder jobs. It's a culture of be strong. Don't talk about, you know, the pain you feel. If you do talk about it, make jokes about it, but don't, you know, don't show vulnerability as kind of a job requirement, you know?
Yeah. So, you know, that's the thing now, you know, fast forward to this century versus the last century of working with similar issues. We have a lot of models out there that have been really helpful in helping us understand trauma. One of them, very popular, is the window of tolerance model. Talking about expanding people's level of being able to tolerate either hyperactivation or hypoactivation or both, because a lot of times people have both. But, you know, as I've come through these last 10 years, probably, when you're working with expressive kinds of things that you can offer people, like, you know, just maybe they're image making or they're making sound on a drum or we're doing movement together or enactment, any of these, or playful kinds of things even. There's another thing that happens there, and it helped me kind of reframe that language, and it's about capacity. And, you know, the military really helped me understand this because as they were doing these things with me, they started to notice, of course, I was focused on it as well, changes in how they felt in their body. And a lot of them had been through some other kinds of really good talk therapies that are available for trauma and EMDR also and different things. But I started to see, like, wow, there's this whole process that is unique to expressive arts therapy, which is resensitizing the body to different kinds of feelings that you got robbed of. You got robbed of joy and pleasure. Sometimes guilt and shame told you you couldn't have those anymore. You got robbed of confidence and self-agency. And, you know, doing some of these simple things and starting to change your body posture or get invested in something that makes you really curious, even if it's just for a few minutes, mediates those fear responses, that terror, that anxiety. And I started to think, like, no, okay, window of tolerance is fine. I've explained that to patients over the years, but we really have a different thing going on here, which is, I call it a circle of capacity. It's kind of a work in progress. And how do you expand that to use these methods to help with your own regulation and co-regulation, and also access these things that you were robbed of by trauma, traumatic stress, even as a child and maybe now as an adult, and regain that sense of joy, regain those, you know, moments of self-agency and confidence, find your compassion again, access curiosity and playfulness. And that's something I think really differentiates the whole field of expressive arts therapy from talk therapies, again, that really work. You can't talk somebody into joy. It's pretty hard. But if they feel it somehow in doing something, and that's what I really started to learn over, I guess, about this last 15, you know, or so years, with seeing that and getting that feedback. Because a lot of the patients in the military in particular, they like to learn about these models. So we talk about window tolerance and all these different things. But then I kept hearing, counting, why does it have to be tolerance? Why do I have to span my... And I got this a lot actually from female military who had been sexually assaulted, which happens all too often in that mm-hmm. community. And hearing that, wow, you've tolerated a lot. Why are we using this word tolerance? Nothing wrong with the model, but the language. And I just thought, like, huh, should have been a window of choice or a window of capacity or something else. But then I started to think, like, okay, what are you telling me here when you do have these positive moments? It's about your capacity. And that gives people hope to hear that. The tolerance is kind of like practice expanding my window. But when we start to talk about capacity, that's kind of the hopeful thing that we all look for in any kind of counseling or psychotherapy, that our person in front of us has, well, I'm hopeful. I have a moment of hope here. And that's what, you know, it's about what matters. And to hear that we can expand our capacity, that needs to go hand in hand with this other model. It needs to be a parallel way of looking at things. Because if we want to be trauma-informed, that's what we're about. We're about empowering people. So that's been a really interesting revelation over the... Anytime you hear it, it's the people in front of you that give you these lessons. And it was just like, finally, I heard it, and I thought, yeah, it's got to be another way to frame this. And we are being action-oriented and co-creating in these sessions. And it is about capacity. So I hope that makes sense, because I think that's another thing we have to add, all of us, to what we do, is that capacity building piece in people. I think we do it already. It's just like the language needs to be there too. Where are we headed?
Yeah. Well, so I would like to kind of talk about, it relates to the circle of capacity, just kind of for those who are listening, I thought it would be valuable to talk about first, and this is like going way back, but you kind of mentioned in your little introduction that there's a difference between art therapy and expressive arts therapies. And I would love for you to talk about why it's important to understand those distinctions for those who are listening.
Yeah, thank you. We probably should have started with that. But, and what's interesting is there are a lot of people in all these creative approaches that still don't kind of know these definitions. So it's not just the average practitioner who's just listening and thinking, yeah, I've heard about this, but I'm basically a talk therapist. And I don't quite understand the nuance. But I started out in visual arts, again, you know, just as my undergraduate. And eventually got in a program, and they were pretty basic way back then because there was not a lot of knowledge about what art therapy is. Art therapy really focuses on the visual arts in some way, whether it's drawing or painting or sculpture or photography or any number of things, but just think, you know, it's all centered on that. But as I went along, I always was interested in a lot of other things, music and sound and performance, movement. I'm not, you know, I'm not an expert dancer in any way, but I always knew movement, wow, has a role in all this. And so we have all those dimensions out there. There's art therapists, there's dance movement therapists, there are music therapists, there are drama therapists, you know, and maybe there's some other things, but those are the big four. As I kept working with trauma, I realized, boy, you know, some people are really getting a lot from maybe just image making in some way, but it wasn't enough. And there are so many senses that people may need to access and can be helpful to them. And not everybody's way is to make an image. It might be to be moving. It might be to engage in sound listening or making sounds in some way or playing even some kind of an instrument or a drum. And then we got into this century where neuroscience is telling us about trauma and sensory processing is really important. And then I'll just integrate this as well. Again, the military clients really emphasized to me, like, oh yeah, the drawing and everything is really helpful. I'm really liking this. But they're action-oriented people, and movement to them, wow, is something that's just ingrained in them. And then, you know, just realizing over the years that a lot of these ways of being through different senses and communicating had multiple impacts on people. So expressive arts therapy, technically, is something that we look in a session to combine several of these kinds of experiences. So it might start out with, okay, the most simple thing I always do, you know, and even in introductory trainings, is if we just sit here and sigh together, and we can mirror each other. So I say, you know, a sigh of maybe a sigh of tired right now, because it's toward the end of the day. So it's like, you know, where does your body go? Where did you feel that? What was that sound you made? Because if we made a different kind of sigh of relief or frustration or anger, it'd sound different. So that's like just one way to enter multiple senses. And then I say, oh, okay, huh. Here's a piece of paper, color shapes, line mark making. Can you just show me what color is that today? It was a blue, was it red? Was it multicolored, to get that on paper? And then that kind of brings about storytelling. Any kind of image making tends to trigger more story than if we just talked about it. And so that's a real basic continuum of trying to integrate different kinds of forms of expression. Now, I told you, like, in doing that tired sigh, we're not getting up out of our chairs, but, you know, I always ask people, emphasize that. That's a movement. And I mirrored that back to them, you know, and it's kind of a co-regulatory situation. I'm trying to, like, did I do it the same way you did it? Let's make that sound together. But we're touching more senses through expressive arts therapy than if I just picked one kind of silo modality. Not that any of those are wrong. People do practice that, you know, really well. But I just found that with trauma, in order to really get a restorative understanding of where we need to go and how different people communicate, we can get into the whole thing in neurodiversity and neurodivergence here as well. Different people respond to different senses, and we start to find out what those are that are more attuned to them, more resonant to them, and more restorative to them. So that's the kind of the difference. You have all those silos of different ways you can work. But we're trying to think, like, how do we make this integrative? And how do we find out, like, oh, what's resonating with you? What feels right to keep exploring in terms of these different ways of expressing and being more action-oriented in the session?
I was just thinking how the way you were explaining that, there were a lot of words, but the words were very evocative and resonant. I can't even repeat it back. It's like, it's not intellectual. It's not heady. It feels embodied the way you were explaining it. And I think that's what I was getting reading in your book, which I haven't finished. But I was thinking specifically, and I want to bring this in and maybe it makes sense to other things that we'll talk about. But one of the examples you gave in your book is about a family where there was Joey and Christina, I think it was. And it's kind of in the beginning. And
they're siblings and there's abuse going on at home, physical abuse. And the sister, Christina, is kind of what I'm interpreting from what you wrote. Like, she's frozen. She's like frozen, like in a smile, which maybe seems like, you know, a dysregulated affective presentation for someone who, you know, has been through abuse. I just, as you shared this about the way you worked with them, I use expressive arts. So I, like, this comes from my own experience and practice too, but it's like, there's a sense of this fluidity and creativity of the session and a vulnerability that you're willing to allow for, like, through your own way of being that you're bringing. And I think in this story, you were working with these kids in a shelter. And so it was earlier in your career, I'm guessing. I'm sure you remember what I'm talking about, but do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. I mean, you know, we didn't have the phrase, well, those three things, fight, flight, and freeze, existed then because they've been around since 1932. I didn't realize that till recently. I'm looking that up and thinking like, wow, these three reactions. But we didn't talk about people that way, and we didn't talk about children that way. But I would always walk away from sessions, you know, those two as an example of seeing a child that I say, wow, like a deer in the headlights. I mean, what's going on in there? And that was just the survival response. I really learned that really early on and just was saying, instead of, you know, that was dysfunctional, what I was saying was, whoa, really good adaptive coping, because that person's been through that child's been through a lot of stress and danger. And that is the way that child is choosing to be right now in that. But that brings me back to that child, and I didn't learn it then. I had to learn it down the road many times. The one thing we can always do that's helpful for people that have experienced some kind of serious trauma and have more a tendency to be frozen or anxious and frozen at the same time, you may not even see the anxious, it's going on and it's keeping people immobilized, is to get them to move somehow. Even if it's just a chair. Like, getting that started, because sometimes people can't do more than that. They're getting back in touch with a body that they've numbed off to survive. And we can't just, you know, get them up out of their seat and get them, you know, wildly moving. They may just need to move one thing. Mm-hmm. We have that conversation, but motion is so important when you're immobilized in that way. And it can be the first opening to starting to feel my self-agency coming back, even in a really small way. So that's what I learned, I think, from those two. They were both very different. I mean, one was a lot more active than the other, but everybody chooses their way. But when we put them in a space where you can do things and respond to things and be active that way, or not, or just kind of not want to be active, we start to see. Because talking was never going to get me there, you know.
Right.
No.
And I don't know exactly the ages of the kids, but I got the impression they were like around elementary school age. And there was a crisis with the little boy, and he asked for you, and you didn't know exactly, like, you didn't have a protocol to follow, but you sort of intuitively just decided to take him and let him run around.
Yeah.
And you ran around with him. Yeah.
It was a shelter where there was a basketball court. And I thought, like, oh, I got to do something here. I'm not going to sit and try to do some intellectual trauma work here.
Right. Like, do you have a plan?
Let's go move.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I didn't know. Well, I don't know that it had been written then. Obviously not. Peter Levine talking about waking the tiger. About intuitively telling that most famous subject, Nancy, that he always talks about. He envisioned all of a sudden in his head that there was a tiger and told her to run, Nancy, run from the tiger. And it was all imaginary, but she started to, you know, run in place or run in her seat. I can't quite remember, but it was a motion of running. And that alleviated so much for her in that moment. And he was just trying out what just kind of came over him, like, I know that she's frozen and she's immobilized and I'm feeling that, like, this doesn't feel good. What can I say? And that's what came to him. And that was, I think, you know, according to what I remember in reading all his stuff and listening to him, that that was the big awakening about somatic experiencing, that, you know, to really focus on the body, but really important to put the body in motion somehow to start to move things that, you know, have been stuck. And I think that's the thing. Expressive arts therapy, even if we're just making sound, we're active in that. And a lot of people talk about right now with all the talk about the vagus network and all that, and, you know, the nerves that run down both sides and come down all the way to our stomach, that, you know, things like humming or making sounds start to activate things there. We're starting to learn so many things that are very simple that we can put into place. And when I ask people to make a mark on paper, they have to make a motion. And sometimes yeah. that's the starting point. Hey, I know it's tough today. Can you just take that paint stick or that marker and make one line on it? Whatever it feels like. They're all lines are good. No bad lines. Just make one line and start to, you know, get somebody to move that way. So there's as you said before, that's the thing. I don't think that a lot of people in the expressive arts have embraced enough yet, and certainly not even in art therapy in that domain. This is embodied work from the start. We can sit there if somebody wants to talk first and then move into this. So we do get those people that come in. I had children like that even in the early years, and I would be so surprised. They'd come in, sit down, start to talk about exactly what happened. I'd be, wow, okay. But they were disconnected from the embodiment.
Yeah.
You know, so they had the story, but they didn't have anywhere for their body to go and to express it that way. So we can start there and move down into that. But most times the expressive arts starts kind of with, let's just do some things that tap those senses that are more embodied.
Therapy Notes is consistently transforming the way therapists manage their practices with continuous updates designed to save money and improve efficiency. Their latest game changer, Therapy Fuel, a powerful and fully integrated suite of AI tools that streamline documentation so you can focus more on your clients. With AI features that help by generating progress notes from summaries or transcriptions, creating contact notes directly from clients' secure messages, and automated summaries of client history forms, Therapy Notes users are already reporting hours of saved time and energy. Some other recent feature improvements include automated recurring client payments, electronic secondary insurance billing, and their constantly expanding library of outcome measures. The best time to give Therapy Notes a try is now. Sign up for your free trial by going to therapynotes.com, clicking Start My Free Trial, and accessing your first 2 months free with the promo code CHAT. See why Therapy Notes is the most trusted EHR for behavioral health professionals today.
Therapists ready to stop just listening and start doing? I offer several ways to work with me and accelerate your trauma expertise. You can join my Trauma Therapist Network membership community for ongoing support, book a one-on-one clinical consultation with me for personalized guidance, or buy my course for clinicians on supporting survivors of sexual trauma, and check out the retreats coming up in 2026. All that info and more is on the For Therapists page of Trauma Therapist Network, and you can find a link in the show notes.
Yeah, it's so amazing because, I mean, it's amazing what expressive arts can do and how we can shift out of a frozen state or a dissociated state, which aren't always, you know, those doesn't always have to be frozen. Like, we could just be like completely not here or many other things. The way I see it is on that spectrum, but you can't tell yourself not to be frozen, or you can't, you know, no. tell someone else not to be frozen. It has to come from inside. And so how to access that is through.
Yeah. And support it too, and to movement. Try to think about what kind of experience is going to be just right. And sometimes that's trial and error. You know, it's like you have to check in, but it's, you know, I don't see how you could talk people into a lot of things that they're really stuck in. I mean, I can't talk myself things either. I need to kind of get active with something that I know for me is regulatory or grounding, and just pursue that and practice that during all the tough times in life that all of us have. But Yeah, for the traumatized person. Yeah. And I think it's really true. A lot of the literature now is starting to say you have to start with grounding people. I don't know that I particularly like that word grounding. It's been kind of overused, but people need to feel their balance and their security first so that they feel safe. And how do we give them some kind of really sensory experience of that and help them practice that before they can go into a lot of these other things that are pretty scary to explore?
There's a reason why the person is not able to be in their body with that experience, because it was too overwhelming.
Yeah.
And can you say something? I think when you're, you know, you said grounding has been overused, and my experience is I think it's like oversimplified too. It's like,
yeah,
your client is having flashbacks.
Yeah.
Do grounding, you know, and it's like,
yeah.
Or how can I help a client who dissociates? Grounding. Well, yeah, but what you named is they need to feel safe. And that's not necessarily the same to be in your body, but feeling terror versus finding a space in your body that feels safe to be in.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that, like with grounding and also safety?
I think, you know, one of the things that I do more and more with people, and this is also, it has to do with neurodiversity and neurodivergence. And if they are going to be in sessions that have expression in them in some way, we have to find out how all those, their senses respond and what's most comfortable. So I was just thinking, I'm just going to pick up something on my desk here. This is just, I have a lot of these stones that are shaped like hearts, but it's just a heavy weight and it has a feel to it. Sometimes I just introduce things like that. Like, let's just start and find out what your tactile senses are, how you respond to the temperature of this. You find out a lot about people's reactions just to different things. And hey, how do you feel about the space around you right now? Does it feel too crowded? Where do you want, you know, what's most comfortable for me to sit? Where in the room, or what's most comfortable for you to be? You know, there's all kinds of responses to that. But one of the things now in the trauma literature that's really important to safety, and it is a way to start to get at like what will help people ground, is their balance. And you can even do that in the chair with just, hey, if you just move your head, how does that feel? You know, when you change that position, standing up, of course, there's a lot of things we can do with support, you know, make sure somebody's not going to fall over. Because I do have patients that have traumatic brain injury that have PTSD. So they have a lot of challenges. But that's the one thing that is in their finding in the literature, working with vestibular is the way to get to that, whatever we think is grounding and the safety. When, if you've ever had a bout of vertigo or anything, some people have car sickness, you know, all these things, you know, you feel, wow, I'm really out of control. But a lot of people with psychological trauma turn up in sessions and they'll say, my life just feels really off balance, you know, or, you know, I feel like I'm floating. I feel like, you know, I'm not, they'll say they're not grounded. So those senses are turning out to be really important in order to kind of rewire people to feeling safe in their own bodies, because a lot of their sensory channels have been disrupted. So that's another, like, wow, it's a playground for expressive arts, because we have so many different things we can introduce that are tactile, that are proprioception, you know, what the world feels like around me and in the space when I'm with my therapist, but also when I'm in the world. You know, where do I get activated when I'm in certain kind of space? When do I feel balanced? And, you know, I think we're going to find out, I think it's already starting, practicing balance, those exercises that for me, as a person who's getting older, I hate to say that, needs to practice more. It is a really important skill, you know, just standing on one foot, you know, and being able to sense my balance and strengthen that. There's a connection, I think, is starting to be seen between some of that. And then, of course, we have the exteroception piece. And always, everybody does this one in a little bit too rote. It's like, What do you see? Name two things that you smell. Name three things that you hear. Mm-hmm. That's fine. It's not hurtful, but be more thoughtful with that and expand that in some creative ways, because that's another sense that we can learn a lot from. But there's other senses too we don't even have on the menu. Like, I think it's nociception, and it's this perception of pain. And that can be emotional pain or it can be physical pain. There, you know, there's neuroception that Steve Porges kind of, he created that term. And it's about my perception. If I'm with you in the same room, how safe do I feel with you? You know, that's a good conversation to have with your therapist, because you should be able to talk to your therapist about when I feel safe with you and I don't, because that's a very important thing too, to safety. Is to know that in relationship to others. So there's a lot of different things we can work with that are sensory, but the expressive work really, well, you know, that if you're doing that kind of arts-based work, it opens up a lot of different channels to what could be safe, what could eventually be a grounding practice, rather than just going through the lists and, you know.
Right.
Yeah. We've become a little bit too oriented to that. Yeah. Instead of like looking at the person and not the script and waiting for them to give you the message about what is it that I need to be safe. And then I can practice grounding from that.
Yeah. I was thinking too, while you were saying that, I can remember this from my own experience for a long time. I didn't know how unsafe I felt in my body. And still, until I started to feel safe in my body, you know, for the first times, maybe as an adult, saying like, oh, this is what it feels like to feel safe in my body. Oh, the rest of the time I'm not feeling this way. So even to learn how to sense, do I feel safe in my body? Yeah. What would that feel like?
To have that comparison. Yeah. And that's why I think, yeah, giving people this experiential type thing of embodiment, of noticing that, sometimes that's opening, right? And then they know, oh yeah, like you just said, I didn't know that this, I could feel this differently. And yeah, this is a really comfortable sensation I'd like more of, and being able to find that. But sometimes it, again, takes kind of hands-on body-based things to really start to be able to understand that in ourselves. Because we can, as therapists, give people a lot of different things verbally, but does that stick? And when you do it with your body's involved, you start, well, I feel differently. Or I might notice it too in somebody, because they change their posture in a certain way, or they crack a joke all of a sudden. I'm like, okay, hey, that was funny. It sounds like you're feeling a little more relaxed right now. Yeah. Yeah. Those little things come up when we introduce these kinds of practices.
I love, you know, if I'm like taking a moment of observing us talking, and I'm thinking about what you're saying, and I'm thinking, when people think, should I start therapy for the first time? They don't think that they're going to be holding, you know, a heavy thing in their hand and like, what does that feel like? You know, what does it, you know, what do you notice?
Where does it need to be? You know, or then just saying like, wow. Holding it over there. Oh, it's a little, yeah, well, it feels a little more stressful because I have to push that up. Getting back in touch with your body.
Yeah.
In ways. Yeah. Yeah.
And that slow attention to what's happening is so abnormal in the fast paced, you know, productivity focused culture.
Yeah. Well, you just pointed out. Yeah, something there. And when I was in another interview, this came up because the interviewer realized it. And said, you know, you're really providing a way to be, to experience mindfulness. And a lot of people who come from incredibly, you know, chronic complex trauma, the breathing and the self-focus and be curious about what I'm feeling right now is like, oh my goodness, I can't go there. It's activating, it's triggering. And they're like thinking like, well, this practice is supposed to be good for me. I must be doing something wrong. Mm-hmm. They may not even tell a therapist because they're trying to follow the protocol. But when you're focused on something, or, you know, hey, make three marks on the paper. There's moments of mindfulness. It's like, it is a form of mindfulness. And people start to find a way to be mindful. It isn't focusing on maybe a triggering breath or following my thoughts. Oh my gosh, I don't want to follow my thoughts.
Right, right. Well, I mean, spend the whole time trying to keep away these thoughts that are trying to come in when
it's all mindful. Okay. I mean, you know, we're humans. We're not built in a certain way. And the traditional mindfulness practices just don't work for everyone. They work for some people. They're great. But these practices also give people something that they get their focus on, something novel. And all of a sudden it catches their attention and they're really focused on that. And they find, like, all of a sudden, like, wow, I had moments and islands of safety and security in that. I wasn't anywhere focused on that, all that other stuff. And this is a practice maybe I can continue to do, or we can change it up and give you something else that's a novel kind of expressive way to be with something. But yeah, it changes that focus all of a sudden away from all the troubling things and gives you another experience of yourself that could be restorative, or could just feel like, wow, I had a moment when I was just playful and curious. Holy math, I haven't had that in a long time. Wow. Yeah. So I can't talk people into that.
Right. So, yeah.
This thing gets fascinating to me because I've been in the classes where you do, you know, mindfulness practice. And there have been times, oh, it's been okay. But other times I've wanted to run out of the room into the parking lot because I'm like, this is too overwhelming. I'm following my breath and this, that, and breathing a certain way and going inside and, you know, and trying to look at what's there and accept it all and be curious about it. There's some upsetting emotions we're not all quite ready to be curious about, as good as that sounds. It's not,
right.
Yeah. It's not so easy. Yeah. Yeah.
So true.
So nothing's 100%, but I'm just saying, this is another way to offer that to people and see if maybe that's helpful in getting to that place of, wow, I was just doing these marks on paper and all this time passed and I was kind of in a creative flow state. Yeah. Nice little respite there and you're being mindful.
Yeah, that feels so important when you said I had moments and islands of safety and security. Mm-hmm. So it's not about like I was distressed when I came in and I was happy when I left. You know, it's I experienced some moments, little moments. And I think like thinking about my training in expressive arts, which was like about 12 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I remember, you know, when we would do experiential practices, I would always feel really uncertain about starting and really, I don't know what to do. I don't know if I'm doing it right. And then once I would start, I would not want to stop. Mm-hmm. And as soon as it was done, you know, when it was time to stop, I would just feel this craving for more of that, of that, whatever that, you know, it was like that creative flow state. It was something that is like a sense of autonomy, a sense of I have something to say, or giving the attention to my inner world. And then just feeling like I need to feel that feeling again of that connection with my inner world. So it's sort of like, you know, I feel like your circle of capacity aligns with that too. It's like an expanded capacity to be with yourself rather than, you know, the way you're going through your normal life, just trying not to be hurt. Or just trying not to think about being hurt, you know, and you don't even realize how much you do that in your life until you get that moment of respite or a moment of an island of safety. And then it's like, oh, give me more of that. Well, I've been loving talking with you and I'm very grateful for this conversation and this book, which is a super wonderful resource for therapists. And would you say it's for anyone?
A lot of people who are not therapists have read it. So I guess I wrote clearly enough, but it is dense. I will tell you that. That's why I'm trying to write another companion to it that really brings about the practices so that the therapist can use it with clients and the clients could read it themselves and use it. but bring in, because I didn't bring into that book the capacity piece. I wasn't quite ready to write about it. Yet. You know, some of the other things I've been thinking about, which is doing bilateral work and movement and drawing and attachment work, all those kinds of things. But to bring those practices together now that 5 years later, I know more, which is good to say, because I hear a lot of presentations that I've heard over and over again for 10 or 15 years, pretty much the same information. And I think like, that's good. I'm thinking differently now. There's a lot of things I wish I had in the first book that will now be in the next one, because I've learned there's so much going on to learn from right now. I just feel it's just really wide open with the sensory piece, really helping to explain what people need for recovery. And that it's not just correcting what we're thinking. It's kind of realigning everything in our body and mind.
As much as it's a hard time in history that we're living in, it's a great time to be a trauma therapist when we have learned so much amazing, valuable information about how to help people
recover and heal. Anxiety to work with.
Yeah, right. Yeah, we'll no kidding.
To all the practitioners that might be listening to this, we're all experiencing it. So self-care with these kinds of things is really where I've been going to with the trainings too. It's like thinking about who the audience is and knowing, okay, they're handling a lot of people that have a lot of difficult stuff that they're bringing and a lot of layers to it. We've been through a lot since the pandemic and even before that. And we're carrying on through a very anxious period. But therapists are carrying that too. And that's why I say this work for me has been, because people will ask you, you know, if you work with a lot of heavy duty trauma issues, yeah, you've got a lot to process and you want supervision or you want peer consultation or a good support system around you. But doing expressive work is a little different than talk therapy. When I would just sit and talk with somebody for close to an hour, that's draining. But doing this where I'm doing things with people and I'm mirroring and moving myself around and being engaged in that way, it has a restorative piece to it. You'll be surprised. I think, you know, when you bring that into the session, because you are action oriented too, and you're not just taking in a lot in terms of narrative and all the powerful things that you hear. You're also doing something for your body as well, because you need to engage with people. It's not just a watch situation. It's, hey, let me mirror what you just did with your body posture. Did I get it correct? Or the sound? Or, you know, sometimes people will say, oh, hey, Kathy, join me, you know, and I won't do it completely, but doing the drawing or whatever. You know, these things are important for the therapist. So think about that. Yeah, I think that's a really important piece.
I agree. And I also agree that the load is much lighter to carry. It's the same experience, but you're just you're having a different relationship to it when you're engaged with the client rather than just this sort of two disconnected heads, you know, intellectually staying up here while the bodies aren't really part of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly.
Will you say, as we close, will you say what you are offering? Like, you offer training?
Yeah. At an institute now, it's going on 16 years and just
fabulous.
Keeps growing, I think, because people are understanding how important these practices are to their work. So, yeah, you can find all of that. If you look up my name, which is highly unusual, the spelling. You're not going to miss it on Google, and the website is there, kathymalchiotti.com, but you'll find that access to the Training Institute there. That's the easiest thing. Yeah. So we do a lot of live webinars, but there are also home study courses. I always say, try to be on the live webinar because you meet people. We're very interactive with people. Being able to go to breakout rooms, being able to share. We're not your usual big box continuing ed. We like interaction. We like humanity. We like people to get connected. Because Zoom is hard enough, right, without that.
I agree. Yeah. It makes it accessible, but it also makes it, it can feel disconnected. So I'm grateful that you work to shift that. So I've taken up much of your time this afternoon, and it's been delightful to speak with you. Thank you so much for being my guest on Therapy Chat today.
It was great. We had a great time. And yeah, hope this opens some doors to people. Because this is my last thing to say. Everybody ought to be including this somehow. It's not just for people that spent their life, you know, getting a credential in it or training in it. You know your scope of practice. So, you know, find the things that will help you expand in this way, because everybody might need this. I really believe that. That it's not just talk or a certain way of working with them through all the wonderful things that are out there, neurofeedback and EMDR and many other things. This is another avenue that's as old as humans. It's thousands of years old, these practices, really, when we really look at it. And I should have honored that earlier. These are things that humans have done. They didn't just do them to put art on a wall or to do a dance on stage. They're doing them because it helped them recover from trauma and loss and being together and relating to each other through the senses. So that's why I say every practitioner ought to have something that they have to offer in this area for their client, especially with trauma.
Well, I love that permission for all of us to bring expressive arts in, no matter how we practice. And I agree with you. That is a great way to end. So thank you again for your time today, Kathy.
Yeah, thank you.
Love to connect with you sometime again in the future.
Therapy Notes is the highest rated EHR, practice management, and billing software for mental health professionals. Its all-in-one platform is designed to streamline all aspects of your practice, from connecting with clients via secure messages to scheduling, notes, billing, and more. You can trust Therapy Notes has you covered. And one of the best parts, 24/7 customer service with a live person. It's beyond easy to get help over the phone or by email at any time of day from their knowledgeable and friendly representatives. The best time to give Therapy Notes a try is now. Sign up for your free trial by going to therapynotes.com, clicking Start My Free Trial, and accessing your first 2 months free with the promo code CHAT. See why Therapy Notes is the most trusted EHR for behavioral health professionals today.
Therapists ready to stop just listening and start doing? I offer several ways to work with me and accelerate your trauma expertise. You can join my Trauma Therapist Network membership community for ongoing support, book a one-on-one clinical consultation with me for personalized guidance, or buy my course for clinicians on supporting survivors of sexual trauma, and check out the retreats coming up in 2026. All that info and more is on the For Therapists page of Trauma Therapist Network, and you can find a link in the show notes.
Thank you for listening to Therapy Chat with your host, Laura Reagan, LCSWC. For more information, please visit therapychatpodcast.com.